There never was much hope. Just a fool's hope.
Hello and welcome to the fifth, I think, Living Room Times podcast with, Brendan and Becky.
No, it's hard to count beyond four, but
it's pretty tough. That opening line, of course, is an homage, a sad, depressed homage to the end of our last podcast where we were talking about how there was always hope that USC would beat Oregon. And there was hope, and then there was no hope. USC played pretty well for about three quarters, but it was kind of the way that it actually reminded me a lot of the way at Pac-10 games against USC used to go, where USC would be the team that the other guys would keep it close, and they would have a lead for a while, it would be third quarter, oh my God, they're going to win, and then the superior, more talented team just gradually grinds them down, and at the end it ends up being a 20-point game.
It's fitting to me, though, because, I mean, it was your birthday, you spent the entire day sort of throwing up and laying in bed. So
Worst birthday ever. Not only did I spend the entire day either throwing up or lying in bed miserable, but then on top of that, USC lost to Oregon, and Notre Dame lost to Tulsa. So it was just an awful sports day. As that those things go, at least Michigan State and Missouri lost, but yeah, it was kind of a bummer. But anyway, we've got a big.
Anyway, Brendan's 29. Yay!
For Brendan. Yeah, I have one more year in my 20s. 29 is kind of a weird year because it's like you don't really think about it as oh, gee, I'm 29. It's totally like the anticipation of 30. But anyway, we've got a big podcast for you today. Later on in the podcast, we're going to do the world premiere of Barack Obama in the form of me singing I Dreamed a Dream. We've got, our big election preview show, but for now we're going to do our weekly segment.
What was your favorite part?
After you.
My favorite part of the week just ended. We were just trick-or-treating and greeting trick-or-treaters at the house. And
we managed to pass out more than 1,000 pieces of candy in under 3 hours this year. So that's pretty good, I think, even for us.
Becky had bought 600 pieces and wanted to cut it off after that. But then as I was thinking about it and doing the math in my head, I thought, I don't even know if that'll last an hour. So I decided to buy some more. So I bought another 500 and some pieces. And then we got overconfident around, the trick-or-treating started at 5 and went to officially 5 to 8 was the official trick-or-treating window. And around 6:30 or 6:45, we got overconfident because the volume hadn't been as heavy as last year when it was a Saturday night. And so we started thinking, oh, we're totally not going to run out. So we'll start giving out two pieces. So we started giving out two pieces. And then the volume just kept up and it got a bit heavier after 6:45, 7 o'clock. And so by the time 7:30 rolled around, we were running out. And so if we hadn't, given out double, I think we probably would have run out by 8. But that's with like 1,100 and some pieces. So it's pretty crazy in our neighborhood for trick-or-treating. My favorite part really was when I was going around with the girls and we were going door-to-door trick-or-treating. Loyette was really super excited about the whole prospect, and especially at the beginning, every house that we would go up to, she would run up to the door and she'd go, trick-or-treat! And then they give her a piece of candy and she goes, thank you! And then she runs back to the sidewalk and then she'll point at the next house and say, Daddy, I want to do that house now. So we go up to that house and repeat over and over again, and she's just boundless enthusiasm for it.
Yeah, this is the year that I think she really understands what trick-or-treating is all about.
Right.
Last year, she was still a little bit young for it, so she's a little bit intimidated, I think, by going to people's houses. She made it to maybe 4 or 5 houses last year. This year, she made it a lot farther and was very excited to eat her lollipops.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I'm just trying to... There's a clip on here of her... of a really cute little, I think it's this one.
Thank you.
Your cute little voice. Trick or treat. So that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that a lot.
Excellent. My favorite part of the week was actually going out for Brennan's birthday, which we did before he got the stomach flu. He was not yet sick, but just exhausted from a tough week at work. And we went out to go listen to some Irish music with some very good friends of ours. And it was just really fun. The band was good. They had a nice fiddle player. And there's something very reaffirming about going out and with a bunch of people who aren't yet in the like married mortgage children phase of life and still being able to have a good time. And we just had a great time and listened to some good Irish music. So I think that was my favorite part. McIntyre!
Rocky Top! I would explain the McIntyre Rocky Top reference, but I think we'll leave it obscure so that only four people on Earth understand what we're talking about and move on. So our major topic for the week.
Yes?
Okay, I thought I heard a baby crying.
So our major topic for the week is the election. Obviously, 2 days from today is the big midterm elections. We just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about predictions of what we think is going to happen on Tuesday, and then maybe look ahead a little bit beyond that to what that might mean. I actually haven't entered my own election contest yet. I'm going to do that tomorrow.
But you can enter the election contest on Brendan's website, which is brendanloy.com.
Yes, and I'll have a prominent link along with the podcast to the election contest site. I haven't done my predictions yet. I'm still wrestling over a couple of races, including the one right here in our state between Bennett and Buck. I'm sort of fascinated to see how it's going to turn out, because I think that the Democrats have done a really good job of trying to basically, among other things, frighten independent and moderate Democratic women voters into going to the polls by running these ads about Ken Buck's position on abortion that seem to me to sort of, like, the message of the ads is basically like, Ken Buck will rape you and then make you have the baby. Like, the whole ad is like...
That is not what they're saying at all. That is a total mischaracterization. Ken Buck said he supported the Personhood Amendment. And the Personhood Amendment would basically say that that certain forms of common birth control, for example, an IUD, are illegal. That you can't have in vitro fertilization because conception is the moment that life begins. And so in vitro would torture that.
Right.
And also Ken Buck said that he would not allow abortion even in cases of rape and incest.
Right. But
so, I mean, he's kind of extreme on the issue, and the ads want people to be aware of that. They're not saying anything about Ken Buck personally. They're just saying, hey, you know what? Ken Buck supports stripping you of your rights.
Right. But there's a very, like, sort of ominous, scary tone to the whole thing.
Well,
and they
of
also
course
mix
there
in...
is. What do you think? They're going to have, like, you know, happy band music in the background being like, yay, Ken Buck wants to take away your abortions. La, 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 la. No. You know, and the thing is that, like, if Ken Buck's only position was the one on abortion where I think he's extreme, that wouldn't be enough to prompt me to go to the polls to vote against him. But his position on birth control certainly is enough to get me to vote against him. I think that's a very extreme position to take. And frankly, I like birth control, and I hope that the healthcare bill covers it.
But I'm interested to see how the sort of efforts to scare up independent voters for Bennett versus the, of course, efforts on Buck's part to, you know, tie Bennett to Obama and the stimulus and the bailouts and all those things will work. I think that the Senate race is going to probably get more votes than the governor's race, which is unusual.
Well, and besides the Bennett's people and the Democratic committee that's been pouring tons of money into Colorado, has pulled up some really great footage for Michael Bennett of Buck saying things like, it doesn't matter whether Barbie is manufactured in the United States or China or India. And so, I mean, if you're somebody who's been in manufacturing, who's lost their job, and you see your potential Senate candidate saying something like that, I'd probably vote for the other guy.
Right.
And they have a couple of very devastating ads for Ken Buck that way.
Right.
That I think have been pretty powerful. But, I mean, Bennett's just, oh my God. He is just so unappealing. The man is exactly what politics needs. He's bland and he's paperwork passionate. But interpersonally and politically, like, he is not the kind of guy that you would... that you would go to listen to him talk, or who could excite you into anything.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think he could entice me to buy a taco. But the fact of the matter is that, like, he's very responsible, and he's very, he's just bland is what he is. He's very bland. It makes you want to hold your nose and vote for him. But at the same time, I'm holding my nose. Intellectually, I know he's a good choice. It's just passionately, he leaves me like a limp noodle.
So there's the, you know, that race, obviously being our local race, is a big one to watch. The Nevada Senate race between Reed and Engel, as I like to call it, giant douche against turd sandwich, is a fascinating race. It looks like Engel may win, and I mean, I just don't envy the voters of Nevada that race. I'm really curious to see if none of these candidates gets its best showing ever, because I would think that it probably should. But overall,
what do you mean by that?
Nevada has a ballot option called None of These Candidates.
Oh, okay. That, because I was like, what on earth are you talking about, man?
Yeah. The Alaska Senate race is fascinating because you had the Tea Party candidate Joe Miller beat Lisa Murkowski in the primary. Lisa Murkowski decided to run as a write-in, and she may win now. The polls suggest that she may win.
And Murkowski and Palin hate each other.
Right.
So that's just another thing. Like, Palin's going up to Alaska being like, all right, y'all, let's all vote for Joe Miller because he's our hopey changey guy. and you know, Murkowski might still win, and it's interesting to see how the people of Alaska don't like Sarah Palin.
And Murkowski's been running all these ads just trying to get people to spell her name right, or at least close to right, because they can get it slightly wrong and the write-in votes will still count, but if they totally screw it up, it might not count. So she's been putting all this money into convincing people, telling people how to spell her name. But the overall picture in the Senate, you know, all along it's been pretty clear that there's, I mean, the Republicans start out with 51 seats, or with 41 seats, thanks to Scott Brown. And then it's the Massachusetts Republican who won back in January to give them get them from 40 to 41.
Oh, yeah.
So then it's been pretty clear for some time that they're definitely going to get to at least 44 because they've got Indiana and
North Dakota
and Arkansas in the bag. Indiana and North Dakota both had high-profile Democrats retire, and there's just nobody really popular enough to replace them in those Republican states. And then Arkansas is also a pretty red state, and Blanche Lincoln's very unpopular. So those three states are gone. Delaware was on that list, the states that are gone. And I used to say, oh, there's definitely 45 the Republicans have. And then, of course, they gave away Delaware. So they've got 44.
Which is a theme that we'll touch back on later, is the Tea Party's impact on the GOP and how dangerous the Tea Party actually is to the GOP and not to the Democrats.
Well, maybe that's one way of looking at it. That's Becky's perspective.
Yeah, exactly. And we can disagree on it later. But Christine O'Donnell is the most ridiculously poor candidate that you could possibly have elected in Delaware.
Yeah.
And there's no way she can win.
Yeah.
Absolutely no way. And I hate to say that to like the right hardcore Twitterati who seem to think that like O'Donnell has a chance.
She's going
to
pull some sort of miraculous upset.
Oh, yeah. It's the October surprise, or the November surprise, I suppose, is that O'Donnell's going to win. And it has been ridiculous, the false hope that these people have, because there's no way she can win. No way.
That's not like rooting for USC to beat Oregon. That's like rooting for Washington State to beat Oregon.
That's like rooting for Buffalo to beat Oregon. I mean, it's ridiculous. And then the fact that so much money has gone to that race is a great example of what I'm going to talk about later, about how the Tea Party has no sensibility whatsoever.
Yeah.
And how they're going to misappropriate their resources into races that they can't possibly win.
Yeah.
Delaware.
So anyway, the GOP gets to 44 pretty easily. Then you look at Pennsylvania, which looked to be in the bag. Sestak's made a little bit of a comeback. He's the Democratic candidate. But it looks pretty likely that barring a much less positive night than the Republicans would be expecting overall, they should get Pennsylvania and they should get Wisconsin too. I have to say, losing Wisconsin is kind of a shame. Russ Feingold, the Democrat there, I don't agree with him on everything. He's pretty liberal. He's more left than me, but he's one of the more principled senators, I think, in terms of just a...
And why is he out?
He's going to lose because it's a swing state and...
Oh, it's a down year.
It's a tough year to be Democrat. You know, I mean, I don't think he's done anything in particular that made him so unpopular, but it's just tough. But he's somebody who... I feel like the Senate is better for having Russ Feingold in it. But he looks like he's going to lose. And so that'll get the Republicans to 46. And then you get to the swing states. And the swing states are Colorado, Nevada, Illinois, and West Virginia. Colorado, we already talked about. Illinois is kind of like...
Oh, you didn't make a prediction for Colorado.
No, I haven't made
who's going to win?
Just
who's going to win? Bennett or Buck? Say it right now. Balls out. Let's see it.
I reserve the right to contradict myself when I actually do my predictions for the contest because I haven't decided yet. But for the purposes of this discussion, I'll say Buck wins.
Oh, see, I'm going to say Bennett's going to win.
So if Buck wins Colorado, and then Illinois is an interesting race, kind of like Nevada, where it's two fairly unappealing candidates who have both been caught up in scandals of various kinds. But if we assume that Kirk wins there, the Republican, and then Nevada angle beats Reed, which it looks like she will according to the polls. And then West Virginia.
Of course, the polls in Nevada have been polling like all the old people and none of the young. Have you heard about this?
No.
That like some of these robocallers are only robocalling people above 50. we were like, wait a minute. You know, there are actually a lot of voters who are in that, like, 18 to 50 range.
This sounds like a made-up Daily Kos story of some kind.
No. It was like Nate Silver was talking about it.
Only polled people over 50.
Yeah. Okay. He was talking about how he had to redo his stuff because of these robocallers being ridiculous.
Okay. Well, the polls in Nevada have, in the last week or two, have consistently shown Angle up by about 4 points, not just robo polls, but all the polls. So there's a pretty good chance it looks like Angle will probably win there. And then West Virginia is a little bit harder to call because it's a really weird idiosyncratic state, and the polling has been kind of back and forth. But if we assume that Manchin loses there, he's the pretty popular governor who's been running so hard. He's the Democrat. He's been running so hard to the right that if he wins, he's going to be like, I mean, if the Democrats, liberal Democrats, thought Joe Lieberman was bad, Senator Manchin is going to be a nightmare for the Democrats. He's going to vote with Republicans more often than not, it sounds like, from the way he's campaigning. But anyway, if the Republican wins there, that will get them to 50. And then they still have to pick up one more state. And this is where that Delaware thing becomes so important. If they hadn't given away Delaware, they would be at 51 after those four states. But instead, they have to either win Washington or California or Connecticut, but that's not going to happen.
Yeah, well, they're not going to win California either.
And California's looking pretty unlikely, too. So it really probably comes down to Washington. And that's where you've got Patty Murray up against Dino Rossi. Dino Rossi is the candidate best known for 4 years ago. He ran for governor against Christine Gregoire and lost by like 200 votes. And there was a recount and then a court fight that dragged on for months and months. And now he's back and he's running for Senate. And the polls have shown it fairly tight. Murray seems to have a slight lead. And I personally think Murray will probably hold on. And I think that a 50-50 split is a fairly plausible scenario. I bet it'll end up being...
And then it'll make Joe Biden relevant again.
Yeah, Joe Biden can go back to the Senate like he loves. I think probably the Democrats will hold on to 51 or 52 seats. I don't know that I think the Republicans are going to sweep all those swing states. I think the Democrats might hold on to West Virginia. Though if they had to pick one, if the Democrats could trade and be like, let's hold on to Colorado and lose West Virginia or something, they would much prefer that because West Virginia, like I said, Joe Manchin isn't going to be much of a Democrat if he wins. What I would love to see would be to see Buck and Angle lose and trade those seats for, you know, give it to Dino Rossi, who's a conventional Republican, or somebody like Race in West Virginia or Kirk in Illinois, you know, these sort of more mainstream Republicans, and have the Tea Partiers lose. And you end up looking at it, say the Republicans end up with 48 seats and you have Buck, Angle, and O'Donnell all lose. And you say, you know what, if you nominated Jane Norton and Mike Castle and the Nevada non-Tea Party candidate, what her name was, but if you had nominated those three, you would have won the Senate, you know. And of course, I know that some Tea Party people will answer, well, we don't care. We're not the Republican Party. We want what our ideals are and not necessarily what the Republican Party institutionally would do. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is it's going to be a much more conservative agenda if the Republicans control the Senate than if the Democrats do. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts or predictions on these various Senate races?
I actually think that overall in the election, the Democrats are going to do better than expected. And I know that's a very odd position. It's not what anybody is saying. But I think that the media has overblown the sort of anti-Obama rage, because I think that they go to like these like Tea Party events and they're like, oh wow, everyone hates Obama, and you're like, wow, you don't say, like a bunch of racists and kooks hate Obama. Like, oh, okay. I'm joking. I don't actually think the Tea Party is full of complete lunatics, only partial lunatics. But I actually do think that there are people like me out there who are looking at the economy and a little bit nervous and hoping that Obama's brilliant schemes are going to come and bear some fruit in the next couple of years, but I'm willing to sort of keep with it and stay the course a little bit. And also, I don't want to go back. I really don't want to go back to, you know, take America back to the Republicans. No, I want to go forward. And I think that there are a lot of people like me out there who are like, you know, I want to go forward. I want to do better. So,
we have someone knocking on our door right now thinking we have candy. We have a sign on the door that says no candy. We're all out of candy. And it's also 8:30, but no. They can probably hear us talking.
But anyways, so I actually think that the Democrats are going to do better than expected, probably hang on to 54 seats, 53 seats, something like that.
Yeah. So you think in the House, I mean, it's 39 that
I don't really give a about the House.
Do you think the Republicans are going to take back the House?
Yeah.
but just not by a huge margin.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even care if it's a huge margin or not. I mean, I don't give a about the house. I don't. You know, I think that the districts are so gerrymandered that actually the Republicans probably won't take back, again, as many seats as they're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, like, if you look at the seat that Stapleton is in, I mean, you would have to be, like, basically the Democrat would have to, like, piss on a baby to lose this. And I honestly, I still think even then they'd probably win because of the way that the districts are drawn. So, yeah I think that, again, I don't think that it's going to be as steep a victory for the Republicans as everyone is predicting. And then we're going to have to go through this bullshit media analysis of, like, why are the Republicans failing? You know, and it's going to be so annoying. Either that or the Republicans will win, and then we'll have to go through Obama backlash 2000.
Yeah, I had a bunch of tweets a couple weeks ago that I called bold predictions, where I was going through all the things that are going to the easiest things to predict. 3 weeks and one day from now, Democrats will be scrambling around in a fit of panic, disarray, and recriminations more than usual. 3 weeks from tonight, we'll hear many overdetermined explanations of a GOP sweep that can be summed up in three words: the economy sucks. You know, I think that's the biggest thing that we'll see if the Republicans do pretty well. It's just this endless discussion of all the different things that caused this meltdown for the Democrats. And, you know, oh, it was the healthcare bill.
This meltdown. That's the thing, is that, like, it's not a meltdown. It's just so ridiculous. Like, Reagan's polling numbers were worse than Obama's
Let's say the Republicans gain 65 House seats and it's a 50-50 Senate. I mean, electorally, that's a huge deal. That's you expect the party out of power to gain some seats in the midterm, but it's unusual to have them gain that many. So if that happens, what will the media narrative be?
I don't even want to think about it. The media pisses me off. Let's talk about something else.
What do you think about the Colorado governor's race?
Oh, Hickenlooper.
By how much?
A gajillion points. I don't think Mays is going to get 10%, and I think that's the larger issue with the governor's race.
Yeah.
But there's no way that Tancredo can win. He's too extreme.
I think Hickenlooper by 7 or 8 points.
Yeah, I mean, and Hickenlooper's a popular guy. He's a business-friendly governor. He's a good governor for Colorado. I mean, frankly, like, he is the candidate who is positioned to actually take Colorado forward despite the recession.
Yeah.
I think he's a great option. And I think he's been making tough choices with the recession already as Denver's mayor, and he's done a good job.
Last prediction. California marijuana
proposition. Oh, the marijuana proposition will pass. But I actually wanted to talk a little bit about New York's governor's race.
Oh, okay.
I
think the marijuana proposition will fail, but go on.
Oh, it'll pass. Where Carl Paladino was saying all that crap about the gays, and I think that will lose him the election.
Well, I mean, he would have lost anyway.
But I mean, I think that I have seen a bunch of Facebook statuses that about that, because what did he say exactly? Do you remember? I'm trying to think of the paraphrase where, like, you know, that homosexuality is not a legitimate choice. And I've seen a bunch of people being like, Carl Paladino is not a legitimate choice for governor. And he really shot himself in the foot with that. So, I like that it is no longer okay for political candidates to say that, you know, being gay is a choice or is wrong or stigmatized.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. And I fully intend to support that continuing. Like, if you are a political candidate and you're listening to this, if you make an anti-gay slur or statement, you're losing my vote. I'm not going to vote for prejudice and hate against any group of people. And because you have legislative power over things like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it's very important to me that my senators are not sitting there being like, gays are weird. because, you know, I have kids and one of them could be gay. And I don't know, you know. And so I want to make sure that I'm voting in a way that's going to keep rights and give rights to people who don't have them right now.
Paladino is a little bit like O'Donnell in the sense that, frankly, way too much attention was paid to him just because he said these outlandish things, but
no chance.
Yeah, he never had a chance. I think there might have been some Rasmussen poll that showed him within 10 or something, but, you know, whatever. He was never going to win in New York. But I think the marijuana thing is going to fail. I think I don't know. I think you're in a little bit of a liberal echo chamber on that one.
I think it's going to bring out a lot of hippies and stoners to vote. I think it may fail, but it will reelect Barbara Boxer.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to be really close, actually. I think it'll be like 48-52 or 47-53. I think it's actually going to be close.
Yeah.
And I think that it's good because it's starting a conversation that needs to be started, and I think that it will pass eventually.
Yeah.
But actually, I think it may pass.
Yeah. We'll see. So the other thing we wanted to talk about a little bit was thinking a little bit more long-term past the election to what the next Congress might look like in terms of the fact that you're going to have a bunch of fairly strident ideological Republicans who are getting elected freshmen, particularly in the House, but a few in the Senate, potentially Ken Buck and Sharon Angle and a few others, who are supported by the Tea Party and who are, you know, quote-unquote Tea Party Republicans, and what that's going to do to the way the Congress works and to basically the second half of Obama's term.
It won't change the way the Congress works. The way the Congress works is fairly entrenched, but it's going to cause such a headache for the GOP. Like, I think I read an article where someone is like, Mitch McConnell is going to be riding a tiger that's trying to bite him.
It was from the NPR piece.
Yeah. And they're absolutely right. I mean, he's going to be trying to keep these pesky little flies in line, and they're not going to buy into it. And if they don't buy into it, it's going to be a huge problem for the GOP. If suddenly you've got these Tea Partiers who are going to out the GOP as the party of big business, which is exactly what they are. They're a party that wants to lower taxes for big businesses and for rich people. They are not a party of the people. And that's the funniest thing about the Tea Party people aligning with them, is that they are not a party for the working class. They are a party for rich corporate interests. And frankly, like, I'm absolutely giddy at the prospect of Sharon Angle going into Congress being like, wait, what do you mean you won't cut earmarks? What do you mean you only want to lower taxes for the wealthy? What do you mean X, Y, and Z? And kind of exposing some of this stuff. Now, you're looking at me skeptically, but I think that the Tea Party is the best thing that has happened to the Democrats. And I foresee that if these Tea Partiers go in there and the GOP can't buy them off and Karl Rove can't keep them under control and under his thumb, that there's going to be a third party candidate for the general election in 2012 that will split the Republican vote and put Obama in office. And I am absolutely thrilled about it.
I think that's a fairly...
I mean, think about it. They nominate Huckabee. The GOP puts up Romney. And Huckabee and Romney split the vote 24-24. And Obama goes...
Right.
Dun-dun-dun! Yeah, dun-dun-dun! Oh, this is the most beautiful... I said it right here. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm prognosticating.
But I mean, it's not like this is the
first... Call me Nostradamus.
It's not like this is the first time that anyone's ever tried to expose the potential disconnect between the two sides.
Yeah, but it's always sides
of the... Yeah, but I mean, first of all, I mean, you're obviously looking at it from a very sort of jaded liberal viewpoint, whereby you're assuming that it's just this big conspiracy whereby, you know, it's Karl Rove buying off people to, I mean, you know, you're assuming that there's no actual ideological...
There is an ideology behind it, but it's not the GOP's ideology. That's the thing, is that if these Tea Partiers go into Congress...
But what I'm saying is that, okay, it has long been true that the Republican Party is largely the fusion of two or arguably three disparate interest groups. You've got the business Republicans, the big business types.
The corporate Republicans,
the Mitt Romney
Republicans. Yes.
Then you've got the fiscal sort of man of the people, you know, the sort of dumbed down fiscal conservatism. People who aren't necessarily thinking about fiscal conservatism as this...
That don't exist right now?
Yeah, that's the Tea Party.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, you know, that was, like, what... Those conservatives lost all of their principles while George Bush was in office.
No, but...
And suddenly rediscovered them in the Tea Party when George Bush gave a ton of money to the banks.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Those are the people who... And then there's the sort of social conservatives who typically for all these years we've been talking about what's going to split the social conservatives off from the rest of the party. Now all of a sudden we're talking about splitting the sort of man of the people, Joe the Plumber conservatives off from the Mitt Romney conservatives. But the fact of the matter is that those two groups have enough in common that they've stayed in a coalition all this time. And what you're saying is, are the Joe the Plumber conservatives, the Tea Party conservatives, going to go and form a third party? Because the obvious answer normally is, well, where are they going to go, the Democrats? Because they don't support. It's, you know, I don't buy into some sort of Marxist false consciousness idea that really they ought to be Democrats if they really understood what's good for them.
I don't believe that either. But I don't think that they're necessarily Republicans. And I don't think that if the GOP puts up a nominee like Romney that they're going to vote for him.
I don't know.
And frankly, you put up a nominee like Palin, and I don't think that the GOP, like the establishment GOP, is going to support her.
I think the establishment GOP will fall in line behind Palin, terrifying though that might be. The Tea Party and the social conservative portions of the base are harder to control than like the establishment. The establishment will swallow hard and support Palin if they have to beat Obama, I think.
But I think that that's going to sound Karl Rove to his pillow crying because she can't win, and he knows it.
Oh, he said so, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. He's been talking his mouth off to the European press about how the Tea Partiers are crazy.
Yeah. But anyway, I wanted to play a clip from this NPR piece that ran, and I'll link to it, earlier in the week. There was talking about the Tea Party and what the Tea Party might do once they get into office. And this is an interview with, I think it actually introduces who it is, so...
Here's Mark Meckler, the co-founder and national coordinator of TeaPartyPatriots.org.
Our intent is to hold a meeting shortly after the election and before the incumbents get their hands on these folks, because we want to let these folks know a few things, the freshman class. Number one, we want them to know that if they go to D.C. and they do what they are elected to do, that we have their back. Number two, we want them to know that if they don't do the right thing, that we're not going to stand with them. We want them to let Boehner and McConnell and the others that have been in Congress for a while know that there's essentially a new sheriff in town, and that sheriff is the American citizen. And my personal impression is that the existing leadership in neither house understands what they're about to face. This is a new political paradigm. The ground has shifted out from underneath these people. If folks aren't voting for fiscal responsibility, if they're not voting to cut the size and scope of government, they're going to be targeted by local tea parties in their states.
What I find interesting about this, aside from sort of cynical political calculations, is what is it going to do as a matter of policy? And might the Tea Party actually end up being a force for good? And this is something that has been discussed on Andrew Sullivan's blog. And of course, Andrew Sullivan is a huge Tea Party skeptic and critic. But he's examined this issue, and a few times he said something along the lines of, if the Tea Party starts to become a serious force for actual legitimate fiscal conservatism, then he will change his opinion of them in a heartbeat. But what he's seeing right now is sort of more of an unfocused temper tantrum against Obama, and what he sees is more of like a largely cultural response to sort of the notion that everything is spinning out of control and let's freak out about it, rather than an actual focused message of any kind. And the problem is that when you talk to a typical Tea Partier or a typical conservative voter right now about, you know, what should we do about the budget, They want to cut the budget. They want to cut federal spending, but they don't want to cut Medicare. They don't want to cut Social Security. They don't want to cut the defense. We're not spending enough in defense. Obama's been cutting defense.
Well, and there's no acknowledgement, I don't think, of the fact that like when Clinton left office, the budget was churning out profit, and we were in a good point to pay down the debt. And then Bush took over and ballooned the debt. And I really wish that every American knew that like George Bush doubles our national debt from like $5 trillion to $11 trillion or $12 trillion. And then, you know, Obama certainly has not brought it down, but you wouldn't expect him to in the middle of a giant recession.
Well, he's done a lot more than not brought it down. I mean, it's gone up partly in substantial part due to decreased tax revenues because of the recession and mandatory, what essentially amounts to mandatory federal spending in the recession, like automatic unemployment benefits go up, things like that. But I don't want to give Clinton too much credit.
I don't want to give Clinton too much credit either. I think that it was, you know, the Republicans in Congress that are responsible for a lot of that.
But also,
and they forced Clinton to move toward that kind of fiscal responsibility. Nonetheless, it happened under his watch.
But also, Clinton was overseeing a period of unsustainable economic growth because we were building up a bubble, and then the bubble collapsed under Bush. Similarly, to what happened with Obama, except much more in a much more extreme way with Obama.
Yeah, but you know, that's the thing though. Like Bush,
I'm not trying to give Bush a total cop out here, but I think the picture is more nuanced than
it isn't totally that. But Brendan, I mean, Bush cut taxes in the middle of two wars. That is unprecedented in American history and completely irresponsible. Like that the Republicans in Congress allowed that is irrefutably irresponsible. And frankly, I am pissed off because there is no way that our parents should, like our parents' generation and this complete and utter lack of leadership in Congress should be saddling me and our kids with that kind of debt. Their profligate spending is the problem. I understand the Tea Party's rage. I don't agree with necessarily with their solutions, but I understand it.
Well, I think that,
and
I think
frankly, if the spending continues out of control the way that it is now, like if Obama in the next 2 years does not at least address it, I don't think I would vote for him again.
Well,
because it's a serious problem that every politician from now on is going to have to look at and say, how am I going to balance the budget and how am I going to bring down the debt? Because it's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, somebody has to be pissed off and responsible. And, frankly, it terrifies me that the Tea Party is pissed off and responsible right now. But, if, you know, as you were saying, if they become the party of pissed off and actual responsible, viable solutions, hell, I'll become a Tea Partier too.
Yeah, I mean, but the,
but you know, I like healthcare.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, the problem is that You say that, but for the government to bring down the debt and get rid of the deficit and bring down the debt in a substantial way, it's going to mean cutting a lot of things that liberals favor. It's not just going to be like, let's get rid of the Bush tax cuts and cut military spending and that'll solve all our problems. I mean, it's going to require a lot of pain on both sides of the aisle. And what the Tea Partiers potentially can do is force the Republicans to be a little bit more serious about it.
Well, that's exactly it. Come up with a realistic proposal that's not earmarks, which is basically a math error in the budget. Right. I mean, you know, let's actually talk about legitimate solutions, like let's cut Social Security benefits. Let's raise the Social Security age to 75 if we have to. I mean, you know, like let's get real here. Like we cannot be putting $8 of every tax dollar into the hands of the elderly while we're spending $1 of every, you know, whatever, on kids. That's f***ed up. It is completely messed up, and it is pandering to old people for votes. That's all it's doing, and it's ridiculous. And, you know, heaven forbid you propose something like, you know what, baby boomers who have more than $15 million in the bank probably shouldn't be getting Social Security. Propose that one as a way to save some money, and it wouldn't save that much money, but you know, whatever, let's call it $1 billion over 30 years. Oh my God, you'd have like Joe the plumber out there being like, socialism, socialism, and it's like, buddy, the interest on his $15 million, even in the middle of this friggin' recession, is making more money than my husband working as a lawyer full-time makes in a year. So let's stop crying for him. But, you know, these people are ridiculous, and there's, I'm not saying that you should take away everything from the rich, but, like, let's start actually coming up with some kind of solutions. You know, should Nancy Pelosi with her, you know, $15 million winery, should she be getting Social Security money?
Isn't that a little bit like conservatives complaining about earmarks?
Yeah. But I would like to say, Nancy Pelosi, you don't deserve your Social Security money, and you shouldn't get it, and you shouldn't collect it.
What I'm interested to see is what Obama is going to do in the second half of his term with this new Republican.
I'm so tired.
Are you done?
Almost. What will Obama do in his second term with the Republicans in Congress? What a fascinating topic. Sorry. Let's see, will Obama try to do stuff or stuff? Let me be clear, I have only been drinking Gatorade during this podcast.
Make no mistake, it's some pretty strong Gatorade. I've thought for some time that Obama basically is going to come out in the State of the Union address in January of next year and say, all right, here's how we're going to tackle the deficit. And because I think that he's smart enough to understand that he's accomplished all he's going to be able to accomplish in his first term in terms of liberal reform agendas. Like he's,
frankly, he he's done a lot.
Yeah, I mean, got health care through. He got the...
And then, like, his education reform has been very significant. You may not hear about it in the lamestream media, but he's done some very exciting things in education. His race to the top has been incredibly successful, and inner-city schools have gotten more money and improved more under Obama than any other president.
All right. So, apparently...
He's amazing.
Yeah. Yes, we can. And he also passed financial reform. And so, I mean, he's done a lot. He hasn't passed immigration reform. He hasn't passed cap and trade. And he's not gonna. And I think he knows it. And so I think that what's going to happen is those are really become second term agenda items. And he's going to spend the second half of his first term coming out and talking about the deficit, because I think he understands that he has to. And I think that it's his opportunity to call the Republicans bluff. And what's interesting, and what I'm fascinated to see play out, isn't necessarily some sort of Tea Party calling out the Republicans on their corporatism, because I don't see that as realistic of a scenario. But what I do see is the Tea Party is sort of the Tea Party's on one hand and Obama on the other, sort of potentially squeezing the mainstream Republicans a little bit by forcing them to get serious on the deficit by saying, Obama saying, look, here's my proposals. And the Tea Party saying, guys, what are we doing on this? And I think what ends up happening is if Obama wants to be serious about it, he needs to not just come out and say, we're going to raise taxes or do these things to revenue. He needs to come out and say, you know, here are some specific things that I'm going to propose that liberals aren't going to like. He needs to do a little bit of a sister soldier moment where he comes out and says, you know, here's some stuff that you guys aren't going to like, but here's a few things that liberals aren't going to like too. What do you got for me? And make them come out with something that isn't just pure partisan trope and see what they do. And I'll be interested to see how that plays out and where the Tea Party will fall. Because if Obama is the more serious, objectively serious person on the deficit come 6 months from now than the Republicans, what do the Tea Partiers do? Do they all just rally around the Republicans anyway? Because if they do, that proves how unserious they are. It proves that Andrew Sullivan was right all along about them. If they don't, that's when I'm like, maybe I become a Tea Partier.
Well, that's when you get the wild card. That's why the Tea Partier is that tiger that Mitch McConnell's riding, because his whole plan is to obstruct Obama all the way to Obama's presidency's death.
Right.
But frankly, if Obama can out-conservative him in a liberal way, it's going to be a pretty fascinating time. And I think that it may be a time when we really come to appreciate Obama's political acumen, if indeed he can play the Republicans right. And I think that he's had a long time to come up with a strategy to do so.
Yeah. He's screwed up a lot in the meantime. I was talking about this with Melissa Clothier on her podcast a few weeks ago, and I, before proposing this sort of scenario, I said, now, I don't want to sound like Andrew Sullivan here and be like, Obama is a double super secret genius, because I mean, I'm not saying that. He's screwed up plenty of things, and maybe he'll screw this up too. But I do think this is a moment for him, a moment that he can seize, and an opportunity that he can seize, and I'm really interested to see.
You need a haircut.
I'm really interested to see if he will. So, I think that's enough on that topic. And before...
Oh, thank God. I was so bored.
Before we go on to our what we're looking forward to next week, it's time for the world premiere. A couple days before the 2008 election, we published on my blog a version of One Day More as sung by the Democrats and Republicans.
Another day, another destiny.
Yes.
Another lonely road.
It's this never-ending road. You always think it as another lonely road. That's not how it goes.
I always think it that way because every time I do, he's like, it's not that way!
Just be crazy.
how Becky provokes Brendan's ADD.
Yeah. But anyway, it occurred to me some time ago that I should do one for Obama singing I Dreamed a Dream, because it just seems like the perfect song for him. So
here it is, ladies and gentlemen, the world premiere. It should have gone at the beginning of the podcast, but we have no sense of these things.
I'm not Susan Boyle, but I do my best. There was a time when voters were kind, when their voices were soft, and their chants inviting. There was a time their love was blind. Yes, We Can was a song, and the song was exciting. There was a time, then it all went wrong. I dreamed a dream in times gone by, when hope was high and change was changey. I dreamed my mandate would not die.
More passion.
For the GOP was old and strangey.
Let me be clear.
Then I was young and unafraid of beltway habits I'd lambasted. There was no blame yet to be laid, no shattered hopes, no losses tasted. But the tea bags come at night. My agenda for to sunder as they tear my hope apart. As the country they inflame. They bash my healthcare bill with pride. They call my budgets reckless plunder. They call me socialist, say you lie.
You lied!
They're mad as hell, and I'm to blame. And still I dream they'll vote for me. Harry, Nancy, and I will stay together. But there are dreams that cannot be. And there are waves we cannot weather. I had a dream my term would be so different from this hell I'm living, so different now from what it seemed. Tea bags have killed the dream I dream.
So sad.
I'd like to give a shout out to Sarah Palin, because I had no idea what to put in the line about when hope was high and change. I knew I wanted to do something about hope and change, but I had no idea what to say. And then when Sarah Palin gave that speech a few months ago where she said, how's that hopey changey stuff working out for you? I was like, it's perfect. That's the only time I will ever give a shout out to Sarah Palin for anything. But there you go. Thank you, Sarah Palin. So.
That's beautiful.
It's not as good as our One Day More. It's not as long of a song. It was as much to do with it, but I had fun with it anyway. I think we're going to skip the spousal challenge because we're already pretty long. I don't have anything to do, so we'll do that next week.
Okay.
What are we looking forward to next week?
You first.
The election. Duh. I'm going to have some kind of a live blog. I don't exactly know what I'm going to do, but we'll have a live blog of election results and contest results. Enter my contest. And it'll be a lot of fun. I always enjoy election nights. We'll get to see Wolf Blitzer saying right now and
no, we won't. We don't have CNN.
No, I'll watch it on, I can get it on channelsurfing.net.
You're not supposed to confess that. Isn't that illegal?
Shh. We'll have Wolf Blitzer saying, CNN projects that Joe Miller has won Alaska right now. And it'll be awesome. And I'll get to make fun of him on Twitter, which is a new thing, because I can actually include his Twitter hashtags when I make fun of his Twitter name when I make fun of him. And it'll be a good time. I like elections. I'm a big fan.
I'm looking forward to our date night, actually.
We have another date night next week?
Yeah, Friday. Yeah. Yep. And you know, for those of you who have young children at home, you know it's not every day that you get out to go out for dates. But Brendan and I, being the, you know, hippie socialists that we are in a babysitting co-op. So we have a babysitter coming over to watch our girls for free, because I also go out and watch other people's kids as a member of the co-op. And so it really, really works well. And I encourage all of you, if you have little kids, to start a co-op of your own, because this is the best thing ever. Because if we had to pay for our own sitter, we would never be able to afford to actually go anywhere but like Starbucks and have a coffee or a tea, as the case may be. So I definitely love the co-op, and I'm really happy to be a part of it. And we're going on a date. Yay!
Yay! So that's it for now, and I think we'll sign off, since by the time this is published, it'll be Monday, and the election will be in one day. We will sign off with a little bit of One Day More from Les Mis, not me singing it, but the actual version, thank goodness. So that's all for tonight, and tune in Tuesday for election coverage on BrendanLoy.com, and we will see you here, or you'll hear us here, or whatever, next week. Good night.
Freedom.
Shall I join my brothers there?
When our ranks begin to fall,
do I stay and do I dare?
Will you take your place with me?
One day more,
one more day to revolution. We will nip it in the bud. We'll be ready for these schoolboys. They will wet them Sunday more.
Watch them run amok, catch them as they fall. Never know your luck when there's a free for all. Here a little dip, there a little touch. Most of them are gone, so they won't.